Hi, this is Ken Robinson. Get ready for a great conversation. But remember, every Tuesday, there's a new edition of Audio Antiques from the K-Rob Collection, featuring highlights from the golden age of American radio on many of these same podcast platforms.
Welcome to the Ken Robinson Podcast. Get ready for conversation and information from the people who are making a difference. Hosted by veteran Hall of Fame radio and television journalist, Ken Robinson.
Hello, everyone. Law enforcement is one of the toughest occupations around, but did you know that it's so difficult that many police officers are taking their own lives? We'll find out why. We'll also hear from one of America's most famous medical examiners about what it takes to be a forensic pathologist. That's the person who determines the cause of death of a corpse. It's all coming up right after this message.
Don't throw away your old computer. Make it come alive with Linux, the free operating system. Linux revives old computers and makes new ones as fast as lightning. There are hundreds of Linux versions packed with all the free software you'll ever need. Linux is easy to download, and you can try it out before you install. You can run it alongside Windows for comparison.
Take time to learn about Linux. Linux, the free open source operating system. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Ken Robinson. Being a cop is not an easy job. In 2019, at least 228 police officers died by suicide. That's according to figures compiled by the organization Blue Help. That's more officers than were killed in the line of duty that year. The state of New York had the highest number of police suicides at 27, followed by California with 23, Texas 19, Florida 15. Why are so many officers taking their own lives? Let's find out from Clifford Keim, a retired detective who spent 33 years working for the Cleveland Division of Police. Today he runs an officer support unit called SIX. Thanks for joining us, Clifford. Your unit directly assists officers dealing with stress.
Yes, we've learned to credit kind of peer group people. We find out that policemen have a tendency not to go to organized either counseling or help. We're worried about the stigma that comes with that. And so what we're trying to do is intervene with policemen on policemen. Often policemen that have been in the same situations, and so this way they can relate to them. And so if it's someone with a drinking problem, then we try to intervene with other people that have been there. Stresses after a shooting or a tragic situation, we want to try to intervene and have some people know it's okay for the thought process that they're going through or the struggles that they're having with it. I think sometimes we believe, because we're policemen, that we shouldn't have some of the emotions that normal people have. Like struggling with what we see and interacting with people that are in some really horrible situations. I think we believe that people that are in certain struggles, they're going to come out on the other side. You know, there's some things going on. There's some signs that are taking place. But we're either missing them or we're just figuring, you know, it's going to be okay. It's just something they're going through for the moment. And the tragedy of it, we need to intervene as soon as possible. If somebody may have intervened for a day or two, or to get them to that next step where, we get them through those moments when the real terrible thoughts are going through their head. Usually we can probably end up with a success rate on the other side.
And I would imagine the pressures that the officers are under and the danger it's got to take a pretty heavy toll.
Absolutely. I think lately we've been vilified. Here we're trying to do our job. We're doing nothing but trying to, you know, do the right thing. And sometimes in police work, the right thing turns into bad things, mostly not even dictated by the policeman or the police that are involved in it. But it's by the person that's the suspect or the suspect or the person that's involved in the chase.
So how do you spot an officer who's suffering, how do you, usually, what are the warning signs?
Well, you know, I don't think it's anything else that's known. I think the biggest tool we have is other policemen that know that person. You know, we could say in general, somebody's kind of shut down, but if that's the person's normal demeanor, then we're not worried about it. But I think if you have a partner and all of a sudden their demeanor changes, their interaction is changing, if they are an outgoing person and now they're shutting down, or if they're a person that shuts down, but even shuts down more, or talk that just is, you know, that you're just not getting a good feeling about, then we need to, you know, as other officers go, hey, man, you might not want to talk to me, but I know there's some people out there that you can talk to just to make sure things are, or even trigger them to try to reach out to the person that's having the problem. But I think it's got to be, for us, it's got to be close quarters, because any generic thing I don't think would kind of fit. I trust the policemen that are working with that policeman, that see him on an everyday basis, to be the best barometer to what's taking place in their lives.
Are the officers working with the officer under stress? Are they sometimes reluctant to speak out?
Yeah. There's a combination. One is later on, if it doesn't turn out well, or what they think is well, like somebody has to be, you know, maybe removed for duty for a little bit just for their own good, or to make sure that they're okay, or suddenly they're worried about being stigmatized as, and so now there's these places where am I overstepping my bounds? Am I actually damaging, you know, the officer, and am I doing more harm than good? You know, so there's that place where we're worried about stepping into. You know, policemen are very, very private in a lot of ways, and they're very, very much in a place where they think that they're supposed to be able to handle everything, and anything short of that, they feel like they're failing.
Often it's hard for anybody in a profession to step up and say, hey, you know, I don't feel right. I don't think I can handle things right now. It's very difficult for any of us to do that. It's got to be doubly difficult for a police officer. How do you get them to, you know, go beyond that, you know, worrying about what people may think or what people may say?
A lot of the interaction we have is, I think we have to be relentless. We just have to, but in a very laid back kind of way. And we just got to keep reminding people that we're there and keep being available. We have a tendency that when we reach out, if somebody shuts us down, that as a fellow officer, then we just cut loose rather than going, I'm going to remind him on a daily basis or every once in a while that we're still here. So in case that mindset changes, we're right there to step in. They'll then have the feeling, if you're not doing that, oh, he already tried and I shut him down, so he probably doesn't want to hear from me now. For me, I believe that if we just continuously remind him, we're here right now, you might not be ready, but when you are, we're here. And so it's a place of feeling like, you know, there's always a safety net there if you really decide you want to make that step.
How about police administrators? Are they, you know, open to keeping an eye on officers, especially if they've, you know, had to deal with a traumatic incident or a case, or, you know, a gruesome accident, or, you know, those kinds of situations?
Yeah, I think it really depends, because like anything else, I think it depends on the upper echelon of each department. I've worked with some departments that are so just involved in making sure that the officers and under their leadership feel like they have a place to go and they're repeatedly supported. And then there's other departments that you feel like, I really don't know what'll take place if something tragic happens. So they feel less likely. I believe it's less likely that they're going to step out and step into that place. So I believe the upper echelon, we have to get to a place that, you know, we're supporting our officers more, and even verbally, you know, to the public, that we're supporting them. You know, there's a lot of policemen now that feel like we're just hanging out there, you know.
They're being criticized a lot, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely. We're second guessed on things that, you know, we're called to make decisions in seconds that people have, you know, weeks and months to try to analyze. And as I said, you know, a lot of the stuff that we do happens so quickly. Our intentions are always good. It's just unfortunately that circumstances changing that are out of our control. And now we're in the middle of something that was never intended.
And it's not a perfect world out there. You know, things can go bad at any time for anybody. And very often, I guess maybe we watch a lot of television and on TV, on the cop shows on TV, everything is perfect and everything works right, and the bad guy's caught at the end, and it's all wrapped up in a nice little bow, at the end. But real life is far from like that. In fact, it's kind of more like a battlefield, isn't it, where things just, you have serenity, one moment, and then just chaos the next.
Right. And I really believe that the part that people need to know is our intentions. And I'm not saying always. I'm sure there's some places it's not, but our intentions are almost always good. Like some of the policemen that are criticized the most are policemen that put themselves in harm's way to protect the public. And for me, I can think of no other reason other than that they're just honorable people trying to do the right thing. Not many other people lay their lives on the line or put themselves in that position and would do that without a second thought. And then later on be blamed that they were trying to, their intentions weren't good. As you said, things just happen so quickly. And usually in police work, it happens and it turns from, okay to bad really quick. And we have to deal with it as it changes. It's not it's a fluid thing. It's not, oh, we do this and the bad guy's going to do this. It's we do this and now we have to see how he reacts to that. And then ours goes from there. Most of all, the bad situations you've seen with policemen, it's because the bad guy escalated the situation and that we had to react. You might not like the way we reacted, but it's usually dictated by the bad guy or the arrestee, and we just have to do what we do in the way of moving with it as it takes place.
Can you speak to the officer out there who's on patrol right now who may be experiencing a lot of stress, turmoil?
Yeah.
What as a professional, what do you say to these officers when you encounter them?
As we grow, I there's a lot of policemen we're becoming really aware of officers' mental health and the stresses that are going on. And a lot of cities are now starting to act on peer groups and support groups. I would say there's somewhere out there that you have to reach out. And I know it's uncomfortable, but reach out even outside your own department. We're available 24/7, and it's a personal one-on-one number to a police officer. Your department won't know about it. Nobody inside your department will know about it. Matter of fact, nobody will know about it other than the officer that you're talking to. So we give them that anonymity where they can feel like they can have a conversation and then decide whether they want to move forward or actually start to engage with somebody that could help them. So our group is called SIX, S-I-X, and that's for having policemen's backs. And they can call me anytime. And if they want to implement this in their department, then I can come out. I'd love to do that. And what I'd like to do is have policemen in every department in the area with an officer that's kind of a go-to officer that guys feel comfortable reaching out to and that feel that they can, take them in a direction or down an avenue where they can feel they can be supported.
And I would imagine these incidents and these feelings have a cumulative effect, don't they? I mean, and they can come on delayed, maybe months or years later.
Yeah, I had an officer that actually was in one of my in-service trainings, and he kind of laughed at me. Later on, he told me he laughed at me because he thought, I'm never going to need that service. And it wasn't even 2 weeks later, he walked into a homicide situation, something that he had seen before, but it was the cumulative of a bunch of other scenes that he's seen and places that he's been, and he had a meltdown. And actually, fortunate for him, he said, I need to get some help. But he, 2 weeks before that, never in the world would he have thought he needed to talk to another policeman or even talk to anybody about a problem, because he thought we were, like a lot of policemen, we're Teflon. And the truth is we never know when that last incident's going to take place that pushes us over the edge. I don't have exact stats, but 2 months ago, the city of New York lost 7 policemen in 1 month to suicide. So they didn't lose one policeman to a bad guy or an incident on the street, but seven policemen took their own lives. Early 90s, Cleveland actually for a while there led the country in suicides from police officers. So, but it was kind of, it's always been kind of quiet. And I think it's good that we're bringing it out, that we can actually, you know what, we're human. We have places, chinks in our armor where we all have a problem, and that at any time those things can happen. And if we could I think part of it is having other officers start to say that they've done it before and they're having problems. I found the biggest tool we have is a guy going, wow, if another policeman can have that problem, I guess it's okay if I have it too. The hardest part is when everybody around you is acting like they don't, even when they do, and then nobody's admitting it. So we're all standing around pretending, you know, the emperor has clothes on and he doesn't. And so the truth of the matter is I think when you have officers that are willing to step up and say, yeah, I'm a good officer, and yeah, I'm a tough officer, and I've done everything I needed to do on the job, but I have a void here that I need somebody to help me fill.
Do you think the media kind of makes things worse by not publicizing suicides? I know a lot of news organizations don't like to talk about suicides at all, but it affects so many people. It's hard to direct people to get help or to say it's okay to get help if the issue isn't talked about.
Right. And it goes along with everything else that's out there about policing. It's like we're supposed to be doing everything perfect. And so if we were supposed to do everything perfect, then we couldn't have a problem dealing with something stressful or mental or along those lines. So policemen, last thing I ever want to be. And the other part that comes with that that's very difficult is if you in the media found out that I had a problem at one point and a year from now I'm involved in a police officer shooting, they know that they're going to be second guessed on, was my mental state okay to even still be policing? Just because I had a bump in the road doesn't mean I'm still not a great policeman and I can't act properly. But you almost, you have to worry about, you know, the stigma of, he must have been crazy. He must have had a problem. So those are some of the reasons why policemen don't even reach out inside the departments, because they don't want to be known, because somewhere along the way, if something takes place, they know they're going to be second guessed because of something that they just stepped out in to try to get help with.
That's really something to think about. And that happens in a lot of professions, especially, you know, professions where lives are on the line.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, he just wants to, if he's gone through the problem and he got some help, he just wants to go back to doing what he loves. And everybody else is going to now question whether he's capable of doing it again.
Retired Cleveland, Ohio Police Detective Clifford Keim, who runs a unit called SIX, which helps officers who are dealing with stress. Earlier, I mentioned Blue Help. That's a Massachusetts-based nonprofit run by active and retired police officers, medical professionals, and victims' families. Up next, Cyril Wett, who's probably America's most famous medical examiner, who's been a consultant in numerous high-profile cases. He's coming up next, right after this break. Why not join thousands of stock market traders who make informed decisions thanks to the premium features of FinViz Elite? They receive robust, real-time stock quotes, pre-market and aftermarket data, advanced visualizations, backtesting, along with much more. FinViz Elite has one of the best stock screeners in the business, plus profitability research on 100 technical indicators. FinViz Elite is also packed with 24 years of historical statistics and numerous custom filters to help you sort it all out. Receive email notifications about important events, portfolio changes, and stock ratings, all within an ad-free interface at a price everyone can afford. Get full details about FinViz Elite at krobcollection.com.
You are listening to the Ken Robinson Podcast with Hall of Fame broadcaster Ken Robinson.
Just about every county in America has a forensic pathologist, also known as a medical examiner or coroner. That's the person whose job it is to determine the cause of death of a corpse. In Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, there was a legendary forensic pathologist, and that's Dr. Cyril Wecht. He's been a consultant in numerous high-profile cases, but is perhaps best known for his criticism of the Warren Commission's findings concerning the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Dr. Wecht has written 16 books, including Cause of Death, where he explains how crimes are solved behind the scenes. In Pittsburgh, he served as a county medical examiner or coroner off and on between 1970 and 2006. But you also spent some time in the Cleveland area, right?
I have testified in Cleveland and many other communities in Ohio on numerous occasions over the years. One big case in Cuyahoga County that I was involved in was the so-called Glenville shootout, in which I think there were 10 people killed, three civilians and three police officers. It was a very, very big case. It had a lot of racial overtones. What was his name? I think it was Fred Ahmed Evans was the head of the group and so on. And I testified in that case many years ago. So I'm not a stranger to Cleveland.
Okay. Well, we also understand you had some involvement with the Elvis case, the infamous Elvis case.
I was consulted by ABC's 2020. They asked me to review the autopsy findings and specifically the toxicology report. He had been signed out as a heart attack, a heart disease, which, of course, was just simply a cover-up. It was and remains a tremendous conspiratorial approach to the handling of that death. Elvis Presley tragically died a needless death. He died as a result of the cumulative toxic effects of 11 central nervous system depressant drugs, painkillers, tranquilizers, sedatives, which had been prescribed for him by one of his hangers-on, Dr. Nicopoulos. Dr. Nick, anything that Elvis and his managers thought he needed, uppers, downers, tranquilizers, sedatives, whatever time of the day, Nick would just prescribe it. And so there was Elvis taking a dozen of these drugs, paying a heavy price. The man spent 4 hours a day in the bathroom. He was so terribly constipated. He was really all messed up physiologically. He was a walking pharmacy, and that's what killed him. You got to keep in mind, Elvis Presley is a billion-dollar industry. One out of eight adult Americans owns Elvis Presley paraphernalia or memorabilia in addition to records. So you're talking about preserving and protecting the image of a major, major industry.
Now, did anybody really believe that the heart attack story? I mean, even almost from the start, the stories about Elvis's drug problems began to leak out. Why would they try to cover it up when nobody would believe it anyway?
Well, they did try to cover up, and the proof of that is that the medical examiner finessed it. He said, well, this isn't an ME case. It's a private case. He got them to obtain authorization for the autopsy from Elvis's father, had the autopsy performed at Baptist Hospital by a pathologist there, but he controlled it, and he was blabbing off at his mouth in less than a half an hour afterwards saying what the cause of death was. Well, you don't get toxicology results back for days and sometimes even weeks when, you know, they're complex diagnostic tests to be performed. So Jerry Francisco, the medical examiner, I'm sure, aided and abetted by others, decided that he was going to cover it up in that way. I agree with you that not many people believe that. On the other hand, that's what's on the record officially. I don't feel that I have some need or purpose in life to expose the truth about Elvis Presley. It's a fascinating case. It's included in the book because of who Elvis Presley was and because of my personal involvement, because each of the cases that I write about in the book is a case in which I was directly involved as a forensic pathologist. The theme of the book, too, or a theme of the book, not done in a condescending, pedantic academic fashion, but a theme that courses through the book, is the importance of good medical legal investigation and the significance of cases that don't have proper investigation. John F. Kennedy assassination is a good example, where the two naval pathologists who did the autopsy on our president in 1963 were people who had never done a gunshot wound case in their entire lives. Isn't that shocking?
Very shocking.
Mary Jo Kopechne, the Chappaquiddick case with Ted Kennedy, no autopsy was done in that case at all.
Hmm.
And, you know, then when you look at the other cases that were screwed up, Jeffrey McDonald, Gene Harris case, the death of Dr. Herman Tarnauer, the diet doctor, the Westchester diet doctor.
Mm-hmm. High-profile cases. I want to touch on that. There's so much to touch here. But the Elvis case and the covering up his condition, we used to hear that back in the past, when you had a lot of high-profile celebrities, that it was common for maybe a coroner to kind of cover up the cause of death, to sugarcoat it for the fans or maybe the family. Was that commonplace?
I think it was fairly commonplace in many jurisdictions when the old-time coroners were controlled and were part of the political process. If you had money and you had prestige and power and political clout, indeed, a lot of things were covered up. Of course, by definition, we'll never know how many, right?
That's true.
I think that played out in the Ted Kennedy case with Mary Jo Kopechne. There's no question in my mind that the reason an autopsy was not done was because it involved Ted Kennedy. This is not to suggest that I believe he killed Mary Jo Kopechne. I don't think that he did. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about negligent homicide by virtue of the way he drove the car. I don't think that he did anything deliberate, and I do believe she died as a result of drowning. But the point I make is that if that case involved you or me or anybody else, you can be sure that an autopsy would have been done, and it should have been done.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, bitter irony, I believe that Ted Kennedy paid a serious price for the absence of an autopsy. While he would still have been subjected to the moral criticism of his being with this single woman and heading off to the beach and so on, at least all the mystery and controversy about the circumstances of her death would have been put to rest.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been written off as a tragic accident, which it was. So he would have survived. I'm not suggesting he would have gone on to be elected president, because I think he had already damaged himself too much. But I think that he would have had a higher degree of respectability and acceptability by the American public throughout the country beyond the confines of the state of Massachusetts.
Well, that brings into mind another high-profile case. In fact, probably the highest profile case America has ever seen, and that's the O.J. Simpson case. If it had been you or me in that case, would we have received the same treatment?
You and I would not receive this, but not because of prejudice or bias or anything, but simply because O.J. can afford it, and presumably you and I can't. I probably have more money than you, and I have a hell of a lot less than $10 million, right? And so on, and there are people a lot poorer than both of us. So in that sense, you don't get the same kind of legal representation, but that's not special or unique for O.J. Simpson. That's America,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's the entrepreneurial capitalistic system. We don't have socialism. We don't have communism. The medical legal investigation was not done well. They messed up with the autopsy. Nobody from the medical examiner's office saw these bodies for more than 10 hours following their discovery. They did not take oral, vaginal, and rectal swabs in Nicole and oral and rectal swabs in Ron Goldman. They did not correlate the knife that was brought in by a homicide detective with the wounds on the two bodies to see if they could have been inflicted by that particular instrument. They did not retain her gastric contents.
Mm-hmm. Is that commonplace in most medical investigations where work is kind of done on a haphazard, kind of sloppy way? We look at the assassination of President Kennedy. And there was a sloppy investigation, if there ever was one.
Terribly sloppy, terribly incompetent, but conspiratorially designed, not by accident, you see. I think with O.J. Simpson, it was a mess up, not because somebody intended to mess it up, but because people, you know, flubbed the ball. Maybe they were too excited because it was a major celebrity and so on. Who knows? With President Kennedy, the military, the CIA, they selected two naval career pathologist because they could control him. It was that simple. And so we never had a competent medical legal autopsy done by trained forensic pathologists. It's hard to digest, but people have to accept that because it's a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tragedy, something we should all be ashamed of, but that's what happened. With the O.J. Simpson case and with others, I think we can say this, that in communities where they have had good medical legal investigative systems, and you have had a good office here in Cuyahoga County for a long time, you can be sure that the cases are being handled properly. This is not to say that everything is done perfectly or that everybody else would agree with some of the interpretations and ultimate opinions. And I've testified in cases here where I've disagreed with some of the conclusions of forensic pathologists from the Cuyahoga County Coroner's Office. But I can honestly say that this office, as most other communities, Allegheny County, Pittsburgh, they're being handled properly. You've got to take it out of politics. I think the office improved once it was removed from the political clout of the former coroner, Sam Gerber. Gerber was very politically attuned, very politically aligned, and he was an autocrat. He was a little dictator. What he did in the Sam Shepard case was just abominable. It was reprehensible, and because of his tie-ins with Seltzer, I think, the owner, publisher of one of your major Cleveland newspapers, press, he screwed it up. Now, whether Shepard killed his wife or not, you and I will never know. You have your thoughts, I have mine. They may or may not be the same. But one thing we do know, that what the courts, I feel I know, that what the courts ultimately did in response to F. Lee Bailey's entrance into the case and the filings and so on was right, that Sam Shepard could not get a fair trial and did not get a fair trial. And that was because of the prosecutorial bent, the bias of the then coroner's office. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing that cannot be tolerated. A coroner, medical examiner must be objective. He, she must be a medical ombudsman for the community. You're not part of the prosecution. You're not part of the defense. You call the shots as they are. You don't protect doctors in hospitals. If something goes wrong in a hospital and there's medical malpractice, you call it. And you don't try to finesse it or cover it up.
How difficult is it to come up with suspects and valuable clues after a homicide has taken place and there are no witnesses?
If you have good crime scene investigation as quickly as possible by trained criminalists and other forensic scientists, and you have a forensic pathologist who can see the bodies and make determinations early on concerning parameters that indicate time of death, and if you do a thorough, careful investigation and collect things and you're not in a hurry, I would say that most of these cases can be ultimately solved. There are going to be some that can't be solved, but at least you will have done everything that could have been accomplished. You will not have missed anything, including blood spatters, blood stains, hair, fibers, and so on. The scene will have been protected, and then the autopsies will have been handled thoroughly. Body fluids and tissues will have been preserved for appropriate studies and so on. These are things which, you know, in the times in which we live now should be done routinely. It's like, you know, knowing where to throw dirty linen and to turn off the water when you go to the bathroom and so on. You know, I mean, there's certain things that should be routine.
Mm-hmm.
And regrettably, people sometimes get sloppy. They get negligent. And sometimes we still have some game playing even in modern days.
Explain. Does it happen in small-town America, too?
It happens in small-town America. Now, there it happens more often because of the lack of expertise in forensic pathology and related forensic sciences. In many small towns, you have local elected coroners who are interested only in getting reelected. And they know that each time they do an autopsy, in theory, they're probably going to lose more votes than they're going to gain because most people, if you ask them whether they want an autopsy on a member of their family, you know, they're likely to say no. Now, if you explain to them calmly and intellectually why it's a good idea, then they'll come to appreciate. People aren't stupid. Most people have some intelligence. But going in, there is a visceral reaction of a negative nature, understandably, to a postmortem examination. As a result, lay coroners, and even coroners who are MDs that are elected in jurisdictions in your state, in my state, and so on, they're making decisions not to do autopsies in many cases that just cry out for it. There's a lot of injustice out there. There are a lot of incorrect diagnoses. I see it all the time. Like it or not, you know, I'm not advocating autopsies. I didn't write a book to promote autopsies in America. But medical examiners and coroners don't need permission, don't need authorization. They have local and state laws that tell them when they should do autopsies. Hospitals must get permission. Private doctors must get permission, and it is up to them to pursue the cases when they should. One little caveat on that, a little corollary. Doctors are not going out to seek autopsies in many instances, and the autopsy rates in hospitals have dropped to 10-15% of what they once were in most places away from the university centers, largely because doctors are fearful of medical malpractice actions. They would prefer that the death certificate reflect what they, the doctors, say was the cause of death, because if that's what's on the death certificate, that's official. And if there was no autopsy, nobody's going to challenge it. Mm. It's a terrible thing. It's not a massive conspiracy in the sense that they're getting marching orders and instructions, but it's come to be an idea, a philosophy, an attitude, a defensive mechanism, even at the subconscious level. Just let it be. Let it be. We don't know everything, but that's okay. If there were mistakes, we're better off not having them unearthed.
Mm. Have you noticed anything different about the types of murders that are occurring today and the murders that may have occurred like 20, 30 years ago?
Well, of course, we have a lot more murders without any apparent cause. Of course, no murder is with justification. But we have a lot of these so-called drive-by, you know, murders, and a lot of the gang slayings, a lot of the teenagers and young adults that are just killing each other for little or no reason. I would say that the incidence of those is certainly higher than what I recall 35, 30, and 25 years ago. Drug deaths are still with us. Suicides, accidents, other kinds of homicides are still with us. We're not going to make those go away. And as a matter of fact, as our society becomes larger, more populous, more variegated, families break down, moral values are compromised, and so on, I think we're going to see a lot more brutal crimes, whether they be child abuse murders or spouse or elderly abuse murders. We're going to see them. But the gang, and when here I say gang, I'm not talking about organized crime, you know, like the mafia. I'm talking about things that are much more disorganized. Not that the fact that the mafia is organized made their murders acceptable, but, you know, in their minds, they knew why they were killing somebody. Today, this 13-year-old kid, well, you know, he dissed me, you know, or he cheated me, he looked at my girlfriend the wrong way, whatever, who knows? And no, I might as well shoot him, right? Or throw him off a building. Well, why hesitate? These are things which are increasing, I believe, not only in a percentage, but in total numbers.
Are these cases more difficult to solve because they're so random in nature?
Yes, that's a good point. Many of them are difficult to solve in one respect because they are so random, and then you're not looking, you don't know whom to look for. You see, the big reason why most cases are solved is because you immediately come to know what would be the motive, and once you have the motive and the modus operandi, modus vivendi, you can have an idea of who then, you know, in that person's life might have been inclined to have killed that person. On the other hand, these kids and young adults, although they lack a motive, they also lack the intelligence to plot and conspire. And so, you know, they'll do things. They'll leave their fingerprints, they'll leave their weapon, they'll leave a bloody trail, they'll talk to 16 other people before the night is over. You see what I mean? So in that sense, their crimes are easier to uncover because they don't have any sophistication.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that a murderer always leaves something behind, a clue?
I think that that's an axiom which perhaps is overstated, but like all axioms which are fascinating, that one has a great deal of truth. I would say that overwhelmingly, certainly, you know, I don't know what the percentage is, who can know, 90%, 95%, maybe more, that there will be something there if you work hard enough and you investigate long enough that you will uncover something that will get you started. Mm-hmm. But to say that there's no such thing as a perfect crime or a perfect murder, I can't agree with that. There are things that can be done, and there are murders that can be accomplished, but fortunately, we don't have very many of them taking place.
Okay. What lies ahead in the future for forensic medicine? Any reforms you'd like to see instituted to?
Well, the reforms that I would like to see instituted would be increasing expansion and sophistication of medical legal investigative systems, whether they be coroner or medical examiner's offices. We need more personnel. We need better salaries. We need more equipment. It's the age-old cry in America. But these things are important. Where you have budgetary compromises, such as we've seen in Los Angeles, you're going to have follow-ups. Not only in the OJ case, but believe me, in many others out there that you haven't heard about and that your listeners haven't heard about. We need improved systems, and that requires some money, but that money would be so well spent. Every case that you could keep out of court, you'd save tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars. Every case which would have forensic scientific answers that would not be, you know, in the realm of Neverland, with attorneys just fighting all over the place and earning endless fees that go on and on and on for years and years. Murders that go to trial that should not go to trial because they would be able to prove that it was a murder, or in a smaller number of cases that there was no murder. And you would be able to obviate those kinds of cases. So these are some of the things that I do try to talk about in my book, Cause of Death, although, as I say, it is not a lecture series. They're real live, fascinating cases of major celebrities and prominent people in America.
All right. Thanks for joining us. Dr. Cyril Wecht. He served as president of both the American Academy of Forensic Sciences and the American College of Legal Medicine. He's also headed the Board of Trustees of the American Board of Legal Medicine. He's author of Cause of Death and 15 other books, including Exploring the Medical Malpractice Dilemma, released in 1972, and Forensic Pathology in Civil and Criminal Cases, released in 2016. Dr. Wecht did get into a bit of legal trouble during his career and faced an Allegheny County criminal trial where most of the charges against him were dismissed, and he was acquitted on the remaining count. Also, there was a federal criminal trial where all the charges were dismissed, and there was an Allegheny County civil trial that resulted in the doctor reaching a $200,000 settlement. By the way, Dr. Cyril Wecht was portrayed by Albert Brooks in the 2015 film Concussion. In the film, Dr. Wecht was a staunch supporter of Bennett Omalu's efforts to expose the link between concussions and football. Our theme music was created by H. Beats, who can make any presentation sound better with a custom musical track. Why not see what H. Beats can do for your production? Just email hbeats330@gmail.com. That's H. Beats with a Z. Hope you found this podcast interesting and informative. If you did, tell your friends and feel free to subscribe. Thanks so much for listening.